Hey, this is John Amato over at Crooks and Liars, and I'm really grateful to have Larry Johnson as our guest today. How you doing, Larry?
I'm neither a crook or a liar. Glad to be with you.
We know you're a straight shooter for sure. Hey, you know, a lot of people don't even realize that, you know, before the run-ups of the war, you were a Fox News analyst. And just tell, you know, my listeners and readers what happened, because you obviously pretty much got fired.
Yeah, well, the good news was I was hired in January of, I guess, 2002. They paid me $1,000 a week. I was put on the air because they needed to hire someone after Richard Reed tried to light his shoes on fire. And so, you know, the $1,000 a week is pretty good cash. And I didn't even have to show up for work. November of 2002, I was on air with Hannity and Combs, and the issue came up about could the United States fight a two-front war. And I mentioned at the time that going into Iraq would be, number one, a diversion in the war on terrorism, and number two, that the United States could not sustain effectively a two-front war. Well, apparently I was told later that the word came down from Roger Ailes that they had to get me off the air because they didn't want to hear that kind of talk. For December and January, I continued to receive $1,000 a week. The only show I showed up on was, of all things, the O'Reilly Factor. He had me on a couple more times, and then finally he got the word and told stop using me.
Wow, and I always thought they were fair and balanced.
It was unfair and unbalanced at that point. But I played on the softball team with some of the Fox folks. And, you know, we had a miserable softball team, but some fun playing.
that's cool. I mean, you know, like I said, you're just being truthful, and a lot of people, you know, had those same feelings that it's hard enough to fight one front, let alone two.
Right. No, it's just, well, when you talk about committing combat troops to battle, then it's not just a matter of a bunch of guys with weapons running around on the ground. There's an entire logistics network that has to support that, and that logistics network is undergirded by airlift. And it means you have to have planes that can fly them there and resupply them. And just from the standpoint of our air power, we can't sustain a two-front effort. That is just a harsh reality. In addition, you have an aging fleet of helicopters and planes. You know, think about this. The B-52s, which are occasionally called into action, you got people who are flying those planes whose grandfathers flew those planes. In fact, I know one in particular where the current pilot, his grandfather flew it back in the 60s.
That's our modernized, military for you. I mean, it's no surprise when we can't even, you know, have enough armor for our troops. And, so again, it's not surprising.
Well, the entire lack of planning for this operation is what is so appalling, because the one thing the military does better than probably anybody around, any corporation, is they do planning. And the planning that was underway for the war in Iraq was circumvented by the civilians, by Don Rumsfeld, by Paul Wolfowitz, who insisted that they knew better, even though neither of them had served in any kind of ground combat. Rumsfeld had been a pilot, but Wolfowitz had never served in the military and didn't have enough smarts to recognize that he didn't know that he didn't know. So they insisted that the military could do this on the cheap. They insisted that they could go in with an adequate force, and their mythology was 15,000 special forces would conquer Iraq, and it would be like Afghanistan, and that you didn't have to worry about controlling people on the ground. And we've now discovered, much to our chagrin, that not only was that a false assumption, but it's also put our very effort in jeopardy there. And frankly, you know, I think it's, you know, there really is no easy way to recover from that disastrous mistake on their part.
No, you know, it's you know, quite evident right now. I've always felt exactly, you know, a lot of people don't understand what it takes to start a, you know, or plan an invasion just to get the equipment there. And that's why I've always felt, you know, Rumsfeld, if you've read Woodward's book, you know, how he kept attacking Franks about the troop levels, because obviously he wanted to get this war underway fast, and having 300,000 troops meant that it would take that much longer to get the equipment there, and obviously he wanted to get to Iraq in a big hurry.
Yeah, and once you get the equipment there, then you got to feed them. And it's bottles of water, and it's hot meals, and it's, you know, everything from toilet paper to magazines. And, you know, there's just the nuts and bolts of how you keep people alive out in the middle of a desert. And that you know, they just don't go running to the local Walmart or, you know, Sam's Town to pick the stuff up.
No, they don't. Well, listen, one of the main reasons for this call is obviously you just wrote a new article about, you know, Iraq and where we are today and why we must get out. That's the reason for this call. Larry's got it posted on his site called noquarter.typepad.com, and it's called Why We Must Leave Iraq. And finally, you know, someone has put down some rational ideas coming from a military background or, you know, an intelligence background
right.
that makes sense, and that's, you know, not pulling any punches with cliches that we hear from the administration, just stay the course, and, you know, these things that don't make any sense. So let's just, I just wanted the readers to really hear you talk about it. You wrote it really in like three stages, and you talked about where we are now, and what's the current situation in your view?
Well, part of this was inspired by, I was chatting, Pat Lang and I were talking yesterday afternoon, and he just made the note that in 1968, of the 58,000 people that died during the Vietnam War, only about 50% of them had died up through 1968. And again, you go back and look at Vietnam, we were told that we were in Vietnam to stop communist expansion. And so what happened at the end of the day? Well, yeah, from 68 through 73, we got another 25,000 people killed, roughly. And we then pulled out of Vietnam and left Vietnam in the hands of the communists. And here we are 25 years later, and what's going on? We got diplomatic relations with them. We let their diplomats come here, and we get along.
Mm-hmm.
And so why in God's name did we sacrifice the lives of 58,000 Americans when at the end of the day we're exactly where we started? And that's a very similar situation that we're into right now in Iraq. We are unwilling to put in the kind of troop size that would be required to seize control of the ground and to provide some degree of security. At the same time, in doing that, it would require killing a lot of people. And just from a pure pragmatic standpoint, we're not willing to kill that many people, and that it would really raise some humanitarian issues. So we're unwilling to do what it takes to win, and yet they keep saying this nonsense, we're going to stay the course. Well, there is no course to stay. We have to pull out. Recognizing that in pulling out, we're going to really create some long-lasting problems for ourselves in the region. They're not insoluble, but nonetheless, they are going to dog us for years to come. We just need to take that into account and do some of the planning now that we should have done before we went into this misadventure. And, you know, this idea that we have lots of different choices available to us is just, it's a false notion, because, you know, in life sometimes you are confronted with not having good choices. And if you were, you know, as I point out in the blog, if you were at the top of the World Trade Center at 9 a.m., on the North Tower in Windows on the World, after the planes had hit, you had no options. Your option was to either jump and die, or burn and die, or collapse with a building and die. There was, you know, there was no option for life. And unfortunately, we've got ourselves in a very stark situation right now in Iraq, that we are unwilling to use what we would have to do, the resources we would need to use to win. And politically, we're incapable of doing it. Militarily, we're incapable of doing it. And frankly, time works against us. You know, if we wanted to boost up to around 500,000 troops in that country, that's going to take a minimum of 2 years to create the new divisions that would be required to put those troops on the ground. And the only way you're going to get that number of people, you're going to draft them. Well, there's no way in hell that the American people are going to stand for a minute to reinstitute a draft and then to continue to be engaged and escalate combat over the next 2 years in Iraq. It's just not going to happen.
No, I completely agree. And I remember, you know, I was quite young, but with the draft, and I just remember, you know, guys in the corner would open up the newspaper to see whose birthday, you know, ended up where and who was going to get drafted. And
where you were on the birthday lottery.
Right, exactly. And I remember a friend of mine was the number one birthday, and he was going, wow, well, I was number one this year, so the odds are next year I'll be somewhere here. And, you know, it was a scary time. And again, if there had been a draft right now, you'd be here hearing a lot different, you know, a lot different rhetoric coming out of people from the right when their children, you know, when their sons and daughters would be forced to go and fight. It wouldn't be this, you know, rah-rah, you know, it would be serious business.
Well, we saw this chicken hawk yesterday, Ben Shapiro, who's this 21, 22-year-old, you know, so-called wunderkind, talking about, oh, it's, you know, you're doing a disservice to people calling them chicken hawks. No, you're just doing actually, I'd say you're doing a public service describing them for what they are. You know, if you're between the ages of 19 and 22, and you think that this war in Iraq is a good thing, then get your ass down to the recruiting station and sign up. Because if you don't, you're a coward. And Pat Lang has always told me one thing deterring. To this day, he meets people and he asks them, how old were you in 1968? Because basically, if you were between the ages of 18 and 22 in 1968 and you didn't serve in Vietnam, you know, he calls people a coward to their face.
Mm-hmm.
Because at that time, you know, it was something that you had a choice and you could have fought and you chose not to. Well, you know, these people that want to send other children to die in this conflict and to make the sacrifice while, you know, the Bush twins run around and enjoy the life of a young woman on the go, that's wrong. And, you know, not a single one of the senior decision makers who have children that are of military age have put them on the front lines. They don't want to risk their lives, but, you know, they have no problems asking children of the average American to go risk their lives.
No, I mean, it's evident by also when they had their choices to make, they all had their deferments lined up and, you know, they got out of service in Vietnam any way they could.
Sure.
So, but yet again, you know, they're the so-called experts all of a sudden. And, you know, it is a lot. It's easy to talk about things. It's easy to go over theories. But, you know, the proof's in the pudding. When you're there, when you have that experience, that's what counts. And that's how you can only make a really informed decision.
Right.
So anyway, you know, I found this also, like I said, it's just a great article. And, you know, where we are now, obviously, you know, it'd been, you know, a lot had been bandied about, like, is the country just going to go into civil war? And you talk about how actually the U.S. might benefit in the long run if, when we did pull out, if we let it happen, you know, how could that help the U.S. in the long run?
Well, you know, this civil war is already underway, and it's happening regardless of what we do. We do not have control over it. We saw today that even within the Shia community, the Shias are fighting each other because they're by no way a monolith. What's really unusual is that there are at least, and I've heard estimates up to as many as 30 different insurgent groups in Iraq today. Most of them are Sunni, but they're not all, or even a majority, foreign jihadists. And they don't all necessarily agree on the same thing. The only, right now, their unifying principle is us. Their opposition to the United States and their willingness to fight us. Once we're out of the equation, they're going to have to be, you know, deal with their own situation. And as they then engage, because they're going to fight each other with us or without us, once they start tearing each other apart, that's going to put us in a position where we can go in and identify those who are the secularists, those who are willing to bring Iraq into the 21st century instead of trying to take it back into some sort of 13th century religious stress straitjacket. And from that standpoint, then we would have a basis for working with people and trying to promote the changes that we think need to take place in the Middle East.
Yeah, I mean, that's what's happening. That's what's so frustrating. And you even see some from the right jumping off the bandwagon, just looking at this, you know, they're trying to write this constitution. And, you know, it's turning into a theocracy.
Yeah. No, it's definitely going to be a theocracy. I mean, even Jafari, who's, you know, touted as some sort of moderate, I mean, heavens, he was part of the Dawah. The Dawah means the call. The call was a group that carried out attacks against the U.S. Embassy in Kuwait, backed by Iran back in the 1980s. I think it was like 1985, December of 85. So, you know, he's part of a group that has a history of terrorist attacks against the United States. And yet, you know, we're now patting him on the rear end and saying, you know, he's our boy. this has made genuinely strange bedfellows, and it's bedfellows that are not always in the interest of the United States.
No, it definitely is not. And I've always felt that, you know, like, you need, you know, you have to force people, and there's nothing wrong with the timeline, because, again, you know, the criticism of that is if we put a timeline, then they'll just wait us out, and then once we leave, they'll just start fighting. Well, first, they're fighting already, but then they could have just stopped, you know, doing what they're doing, let it come together, and then did the same thing all over again. So it's ludicrous about this whole argument, in my mind, that, you know, it's bad to have timelines where we need to force these people to start taking care of themselves, to make the hard decisions. And also the other notion which drives me nuts is, you know, we have an incredible military, and yet we're going to train Iraqis, and, you know, in 8 weeks, all of a sudden they're going to be able to defend themselves against this insurgency that we haven't been able to put down.
Yeah, well, and we've been unable to, you know, ultimately, you can fight and win insurgencies, but the key to it is you've got to be able to put personnel out there on the ground who can stay there, because the average person, when they are confronted with somebody that walks into the front door and threatens their life, they're not going to be willing to stand up to them if they think they have no alternative. And unfortunately, we just, you know, we don't have the forces in place. And the average Iraqi, most of those insurgent or Iraqi forces that are in place right now, they come out of a Shia background.
Mm-hmm.
And who are they going out and conducting military operation against? Well, they're going out up against other Sunnis. So that is further inflaming this process, where the Sunnis, who already feel that they're under attack, now feel, you know, these guys are really out to get them.
Yes, it's you know, not a good situation, and it's only getting worse. And again, you know, and who gets the brunt of it is our, you know, our troops that are serving there. And listen, Larry, thank you for the couple minutes you're able to spend with us. And
hey, anytime, man.
And you know, good luck, and keep writing, and, you know, keep fighting a good fight.
Will do.
Okay, buddy.
Thanks.
All right, man. Talk to you later.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.